So just a quick message from me before we launch into this week's episode. If you are listening on Spotify, you've probably noticed that only one episode has been showing per week on the Spotify feed, when in fact I have still been releasing two. So a weird glitch has been going on where all the other apps, Apple, Podbean, etc., have been uploading my episodes, but for some reason there's been some issue with Spotify, which I'm trying to resolve. So if you want to go and listen to the missing episodes, they will hopefully be on Spotify soon. But in the meantime, you might want to head over to Apple or Podbean or one of the other apps to listen. Thank you. Hello, and welcome to the Eating Disorder Therapist podcast. This is a podcast to help you find peace with food and overcome disordered eating. And I'm Harriet Frew, aka the Eating Disorder Therapist. And I'm so excited to share with you all kinds of stories, tips, information, and guest interviews to help you on your journey in finding peace with food. So thank you so much for listening today. Now, today I'm talking to Matt Davis, and Matt is a nutritionist specializing in disordered eating, body image, and self-compassion. He is the founder of The Flourishing Athlete, an Instagram platform aiming to help athletes and fitness enthusiasts develop a positive relationship with food, body, and self so they can flourish and live a meaningful life whilst engaging with sport and fitness in a healthy way. Having played elite level sport and worked as a personal trainer and nutritionist, Matt promotes a predominantly non-diet, body-neutral approach towards sports nutrition, fitness, and performance. And he believes that this education and support is needed in the sport and fitness space to reduce the prevalence of disordered eating, body image concerns, and other risk factors for poor mental well-being in this population. In the episode today, Matt is going to talk about his own healing journey with food and body image and how he has navigated this within the sport and fitness space. He's then going to talk about the unique concerns that athletes and fitness enthusiasts can face with disordered eating and poor body image. And these issues are often hidden due to a lack of awareness and the focus in sport and fitness around aesthetics and performance, which can inadvertently drive an unhealthy preoccupation around food and body. Matt is then going to discuss about how we can prevent these issues in the first place and how people who are struggling can reach out and get the support that they need. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Let's get to it. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the Eating Disorder Therapist podcast.
Hello, Harriet. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. So Matt, can I firstly get you to introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
Yeah, sure. So as Harriet said, my name's Matt. I am a nutritionist that specializes in disordered eating, body image and self-confidence and compassion. And I am the founder of The Flourishing Athlete, which is currently sort of exists as an Instagram page whereby I give out advice to athletes and fitness enthusiasts to help them build a positive relationship with food and their body and themselves, whilst also looking at focusing on performance as well.
Thank you, Matt. So I know you've been on your own journey with food and body image, and you're obviously a nutritionist. Before we came on air, you were telling me about you're still doing some personal training, and you've played sport at an elite level, haven't you, as well? And so I know you've had your own challenges around food and body. So could you tell us a bit about your journey and how you sort of progressed through that to the point you're at today?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I've always been into my sport. I think I've always enjoyed sport from a young age, from primary school and all through secondary school, and focusing in on the relationship with food and body. I guess the first sort of time when I recognize a problematic relationship developing was probably in sixth form. And I say a time I didn't recognize it at the time, sorry. But looking back now, I can recognize that sixth form, years 12 and 13, I started to get a pretty high drive for muscularity and leanness. I had a drive for both, which I think is quite common amongst people who have a drive for muscularity. I think there was a lot of body comparison that went along with that within my school and within the sports culture that took place within my school. I was also, I think, had a pretty low level of self-esteem, a low level of self-acceptance. I think I was pretty highly driven and highly perfectionistic. I worked very hard. I didn't really settle for anything that wasn't perfect. I found myself feeling pretty disappointed in myself if I didn't achieve perfection, quote unquote. I think in year 13 was probably when I started getting into touch rugby, which is the sport that I ended up playing for England. And in that sport, the body type that typically ends up with success is one that is lean. It is a sport that is where you need a lot of speed and you need a lot of endurance as well. So it's sort of, you need a bit of both, to be honest. And it's naturally easier to do that if you're lean. So a lot of the people who play the sport are lean. That is the body type that is accepted. That is the body type that is normal. And that is the bodies that you end up comparing yourself to. So I played touch rugby for 3 years odd for England. In the meantime, I went to Loughborough University and studied sport and exercise science, which probably furthered my obsession with sport performance. How do I get as lean as I possibly can? How do I train in a way that's going to improve my performance? How do I eat in a way that's going to improve my performance? My eating became very mechanical. I think I had quite a few orthorexic tendencies at this point, not wanting to eat processed food and wanting to eat sort of clean, quote unquote. Very obsessive around protein as well. Very obsessive around my levels of body fat at this stage. So I obviously went to a university that celebrates sport and whereby your social status is very much seen through your athletic ability. So yeah, I had this high level of investment in my body image and I was very much identified as an athlete, as a fitness enthusiast, as someone who sacrificed, as someone who was able to go through pain, had a high pain threshold when it came to workouts. So yeah, I was engaging in a number of different sort of disordered eating behaviors. I was very obsessed with my body at this point. I never went for any diagnosis. I never visited my GP for anything, but I'd imagine I would have hit clinical diagnosis for muscle dysmorphic disorder. I was spending a lot of my day thinking about my body, pretty obsessed with my body. I thought I was a lot fatter than I was. I thought I had a far less muscle, particularly on my arms, than I do have. So I had this very sort of fragile sense of self. And then really this sort of continued up until I did my master's in nutrition, which is when I first sort of found out about intuitive eating. And I did my research project on the effects of intuitive eating in people who have spent a long time dieting in the past and have sort of switched to a non-diet method. And I sort of found this really interesting. It sort of maybe brought to light a lot of the issues that were swept under the carpet, but were also normalized within the fitness and sporting environment that I was in. I say that, and I don't think people were intentionally trying to harm me in any way whatsoever. I think it was just the culture that exists, unfortunately, within fitness and sport, is that these eating behaviors are often celebrated and the body obsession is often seen as something that is pretty normal, I think. You know, high levels of discipline and high levels of dedication and all of that stuff. So yeah, once I found out about intuitive eating, I really delved into the research. I started engaging in a lot of the self-help material. I started reading a lot about body image, which led me on to self-compassion, self-acceptance, self-esteem, and all of these interesting issues, which often are sitting underneath, well, for me at least, were certainly sitting underneath the disordered eating and the body obsession. So that was where the flourishing athlete is born out of and wanting to prevent that from happening to other athletes and helping athletes develop a stable sense of self, high levels of self-compassion, a positive relationship with food and body so that they can flourish within their sport or within fitness, but also within life as well.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. And I think it's fantastic that you are sort of sharing your story really openly, because I think this is a story that many people will relate to, but it's still something that isn't talked about openly, is it? I think, and perhaps it's particularly harder for men and in the whole sort of fitness space and elite sport.
100%. I think we've certainly made progress probably in the past few years, but there's a long, long way to go. And as I said, it was incredibly normalized for myself, these behaviors, but then also seeking help, particularly within athletes, I think is seen as a sign of weakness, as a sign of instability. And I think that message is starting to change, which is good. But yeah, particularly for male athletes, I think I'm good friends with George Mycock, who I know you've had on your podcast, I believe. He talks about masculinity a lot. So obviously sort of that side of how your body represents masculinity and how you failed as a man if you don't look a certain way and you don't have certain characteristics that are portrayed through your appearance. And I think sports has a similar thing, and it doesn't necessarily have to be split into masculinity and, I was going to say, femininity, which is absolutely not a word. What's the equivalent of masculinity for females?
You know, I think it is femininity.
Femininity. Femininity, we'll go with that. I think for sport, there's also this pressure to appear a way that matches the sport that you play. And I think that there's this level of acceptance and esteem that you'll get from other people from feeling like you found your tribe. And if that tribe is people who appear lean or people who appear extremely muscly, like if we look at bodybuilders, for example, I think a lot of people will get into the gym, they'll gain some muscle, they'll feel like they've found a level of respect and self-esteem from building muscle because it's celebrated within the particular group of people that they found within the gym, and they found their bros and they found the people that will understand them. I understand, you get me, the pain I have to go through and the way that sacrifice I'm going to give to look this way, to feel accepted within this group. And I think that happens in a lot of different sports that have different body ideals or pressures to look a certain way. So I think this can all manifest differently in different sports, and it can manifest differently for males and females. But yeah, I hope that by sharing my story, other people that do relate don't feel alone and feel like there's certainly other ways of relating to sport in a slightly more healthy way.
And it sounds like sort of when you were in the midst of it, in a way, perhaps you didn't really even recognize that you had a problem. You probably just thought you were kind of being like really healthy. And that was quite validated maybe by people around you as well, like perhaps feeling that you're part of the tribe, being respected, getting the gains or whatever. I'm guessing you got quite a lot of sort of validation for that.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny because I look back as you say that, and I'm trying to think about overt examples of people sort of complimenting it. I don't necessarily resonate with people going, yeah, you're great because you're restricting your food. But I think you pick up on a lot of body talk. There's a lot of body monitoring, and we know that when we monitor our body, we have a greater investment in our appearance, and that's a really big risk factor for disordered eating. And according to certain theories, is the thing that can keep certain eating disorders going. I just think that there's a hell of a lot of investment in your appearance. And there's also the message that's given out of a sort of a win at all costs mentality. And I don't know how much within the sporting space one's relationship with food is even considered, or even amongst sports professionals or fitness professionals. And this is something that I absolutely advocate for changing, is people need to have an understanding of what disordered eating, eating disorders and body image problems look like, because without that understanding, it's very easy being a coach removed from the pressure of eating a certain way and performing a certain way to perpetuate issues and problematic cultural standards or ideals within a team or within a gym culture or whatever it might be, that can really feed into an individual struggling with their relationship with food and body and not even realizing they're struggling because the coach is saying this is what you have to do. I'm not saying for one second that that's my experience, but I wouldn't half be surprised if that was a fair amount of people's experiences.
Well, it's so tricky, isn't it? I guess as well, when perhaps the coach is very focused on sort of physical goals, performance goals, or aesthetic goals. Yeah, the relationship with food side isn't really taken into account maybe often. And maybe some sort of disordered eating practices are almost kind of normalized or seen as part of the process maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a really funny one. I find this is probably why I'm so interested in this side of it all, because I think with the original intuitive eating model, which is what I did my research project on when I was at university, and I'm a massive fan of, and I found really, really interesting, it isn't marketed towards athletes or fitness enthusiasts. It looks at a framework for eating, maybe for chronic dieters, for people who have spent a long time dieting, most likely for health and or aesthetic reasons. I think there's often an aesthetic reason when we live in a culture that values appearance so highly. I think it's very hard for them not to be one, unless people have been educated fully around appearance ideals and media and all of this stuff. So I did that and I thought it was fantastic. But within this space, you're right, there's a lot of nuance. Within the athletic space, there's a lot of nuance, because you're right, there are certain sports, if I take bodybuilding, I personally believe it's impossible to have an optimal relationship with food and compete in bodybuilding. I think there's things you can do to navigate improving a relationship with food whilst maintaining a role in that sport, even competitively. But I don't think you can ever optimize it. And if we're calling from the research, if we're calling eating intuitively with a lack of food preoccupation, eating when hungry, stopping when full, enjoying different foods, feeling a sense of peace and an attitude around food that allows you to have a sense of peace, I don't think that bodybuilding is conducive to that. Other sports that might be easier to do. If we take, you know, and I'm by no means saying that you cannot struggle with your relationship with food with these sports, but if you took cricket, for example, there is not as much of a body ideal. And in fact, different bodies might have different roles that they suit better. If you're taller, you might be a better pace bowler. And there's different sort of, if you're shorter, you might be a better wicket keeper. It's a sport that involves many different facets other than a facet that is dependent upon your body being a certain weight, shape. And actually virtually every sport, apart from extreme sports like bodybuilding, which is purely aesthetic, will not solely rely on your body weight being a certain weight or shape. If we take footballers, in fact, let's take the sport I played, touch rugby. There were people in the team who would be fitter than myself, i.e. score higher on certain fitness tests, maybe have a better VO2 max, not that we ever tested that, than me, yet maybe held more body fat than I did. There is not a direct correlation between body fat and performance. There is if you're a professional bodybuilder or a competitive bodybuilder on stage at the end, that is directly what you are being scored on. And I don't believe the sport to be one that is conducive to health personally. But for a number of other sports, there are other skills and other ways that we can eat, ways that we can train that respect our body, that respect the differences in bodies that exist along a spectrum, and that don't sort of end up causing or perpetuating harmful eating behaviors and attitudes. And I think that's really the work that I'm trying to do with the Flourishing Athlete, is navigate this nuanced space where how do we help people eat and view their body in a way that brings them peace and that allows them to flourish, but also promotes sporting performance at the same time if it comes from a healthy place and comes from a healthy motivational system. So I think that's probably a nice summary of what the Flourishing Athlete tries to do. And it does that through an attitude. I guess that's what the Flourishing Athlete is in a way, is it's an attitude and it's a way of doing things. And it's a model, I guess. So I guess that's the aim of it, really.
Yeah, and it sounds like for many sports, I guess, actually, it probably is possible to be in a more kind of balanced, nuanced place with your nutrition and the whole kind of spectrum of health, isn't it? But like, as you're saying, in a way, perhaps if you're doing bodybuilding, thinking of some other sports, maybe like as well, if you're a jockey, you have to be like really small, or like ballet dancers, gymnasts. For some of those sports, there's definitely more pressure, isn't there? Or when you've got to be a certain weight or something.
100%. I think having an awareness of that is absolutely critical, in that actually there is a massive effect of genetics on our body weight and shape, our ability to gain muscle, our ability to gain strength. Is very much based in the genetics we're given a lot of the time. That's not me saying you can't do things to change them. And it's not me saying we should never work because we're doomed because of our genetics. But what it is saying is that if I try changing my height from 6 foot to 6 foot five so that I can be a professional basketball player, it's recognized that that's not going to be able to be done. And yet trying to compete in a weight class that is far, far too low for us is not as recognized that that shouldn't be done. And actually, sure, okay, height is based, happy to say, 100% genetics, or well, close to 100%. I'm sure there is some environmental factors early on in life. But our body weight is also based within genetics. Some people will respect all sort of when eating, when they're hungry and stopping when they're full, will be a different body weight to other people. And understanding that really our body typically picks the sport more than we pick the sport as a human, as a cognitive being, I think is a really important thing, because we may well sort of get into a sport from a young age. We are praised for that sport. We get a lot of social status from competing in that sport. We've always been good at it. We've always received praise from being good at it throughout school. And then we go through puberty. Our bodies change and we grow up. And actually, our body doesn't really suit this sport anymore. But we do our best to continue to gain that social status and feel good about ourselves, because all of our self-esteem is based on our ability within this sport. And so we try to conform to a certain body type that doesn't suit our genetics. And we end up getting ourselves into a bit of a sticky situation. So I think just simple education even about that, and to coaches as well, so that they know what to monitor, and sports nutritionists and anyone involved, and even people who are into their fitness who might enjoy doing certain, thinking CrossFit and HYROX, but also people who have a high level or high drive for muscularity, who sort of, you know, have gone through sixth form and all their mates are talking about getting wham and putting on muscle. Or I don't know what the female equivalent is, because I haven't experienced that myself. I'm just talking from my own experience here as a male going through sixth form and all the talk around getting jacked and, oh my God, have you seen how much this guy's grown over summer when you come back for year 13? An understanding for people, but also for, you know, teachers, for sports coaches, for people involved with working with this population, I think would go a long way in helping people feel more comfortable seeking help, or even being approached to seek help when appropriate.
Time for a short advertisement break. Now, I know we talk a lot about food freedom on this podcast and how important it is to take care of yourself mentally and physically as you learn to navigate a culture inundated with toxic messaging. One of the best ways to take care of yourself is through exercise, but I know it can be really hard to find an exercise program that isn't rooted in these toxic messages and doesn't feel triggering. Well, I recently met Katie, the owner of an amazing new exercise company called WeShape. WeShape doesn't focus on calorie counting, tracking how much you work out, or making you feel bad about your body to get you motivated. Instead, they create a customized exercise routine for you that helps you connect with and care for your body rather than feel the pressure to change it. They help you learn to set intentions that come from a place of self-care rather than self-judgment, and they support you every step of the way with an amazing community and live coaching so you can make exercise a self-care practice that helps you feel better in your body and about your body. Plus, they're giving listeners of the show the chance to try it out for 2 full weeks for free. Just head on over to weshape.com/freedom or check out the link in the show notes to get started today. I think that education piece, it sounds like so important in prevention, doesn't it? Because I'm always just thinking as well, if you've got someone, say a ballet dancer or something, someone who's about, I don't know, 10, 11 years old, and they already, like, you can see they're this kind of perfectionist, and then perhaps they start to go through puberty a bit older, and you can kind of see all the risk factors there. Like, you know, like when you were sort of talking earlier about kind of bodybuilding, and actually I think it is very challenging, isn't it, to have a healthy relationship with food when you're kind of continuously going through those cycles. But I'm just thinking as well, for some people as well, actually certain careers or certain paths in sport may just not be great for them, actually. And it's tricky, isn't it? Like, I'm just wondering, in terms of like prevention work and educating people, so people are just a bit more aware of some of these things as well, it may be possible to take a step back from something, even if it's been really part of your identity and had so much meaning. That's hard, isn't it? But I don't know if you have any sort of thoughts around that.
I think it's very hard, isn't it? I think you talk about, and very hard in practice. Yeah. I think that one of the key parts that I promote within this model is making sure that we are not simply athletes and not identifying simply as an athlete. Because if someone would have ever, let's take my time at Loughborough University, if they'd have asked, oh, who are you, or what do you do? It would have very much been, oh, I'm an athlete. I train twice a day, and no, I don't eat sugar, and I help people beast themselves in the gym. And that was who I was, and that was everything of who I was. I wouldn't have said, oh yeah, I'm a brother, I'm a mate, I like going out sometimes, and I actually quite like films, and I wouldn't have said any of those things. I was, if you know, that classic sort of pie chart representation. I was highly identified as an athlete, and in my head, an athlete had to look a certain way as well. So if I drew two separate pie charts, I was a touch rugby player and fitness enthusiast, and 90% of my identity was that. And if I drew another chart of what is a touch rugby player and fitness enthusiast, 90% of that pie chart would have been based on appearance. I was missing out the ability to pass, the ability to catch, the ability to do a good roll ball, to dump, to make good touches, to dive, to pace, all of these different things that actually, some of them have something to do with your body composition, but you can train for those things in the gym and eat in a way that supports those things without focusing on body composition and aesthetics. I think that's the thing that makes the blow slightly less crushing, is if we have built up a stable sense of self rather than one that is purely focused on sport. And I'm very much a believer as well that athletes perform best when they have things where they can take their mind off of the sport, where they don't feel unbelievable amount of pressure to perform within a certain sport. And that means devaluing that sport a little bit if we're overvaluing it, which is a really hard thing to do because it might be something that's been built up over time. And if it's something where we feel a sense of belonging and we feel a sense of we get praised from a social perspective, that's a high, high evolutionary developed system, motivational system, to want praise from others, to want to impress others, to want to feel accepted by others and feel accepted within a group. That's really, really innate. And that can be really hard to break out of. So we also need to look at trying to have friends outside of athletic pursuits and trying to make sure that we have other aspects to us. And that's one part of the model, which I think is important because it doesn't make it so crushing when we get injured inevitably, when we don't get picked for a team inevitably, or when something goes wrong. Or maybe if we do need to step away from the sport altogether, or maybe we step away from competing in the sport for a period of time. Maybe we explore other avenues. But yeah, I think those things soften the blow, but it can be a really challenging thing to do in the moment.
That identity piece is so important, isn't it? And it makes so much sense. And I'm just sort of thinking as well, I'm thinking about Katie McDonald, actually, the parkour athlete, talking about sort of when she was at the height of her fame, if that's the right word for it, you know, when she was like really doing a lot of competitions and things a few years ago, that she became so dependent. She talked about this really openly on a podcast recently, with that kind of external validation. Is it becomes this sort of self-perpetuating cycle, doesn't it, in a way where you can, you know, you're looking a certain way, you're doing certain things, people then really praise you for it. And even if you weren't externally validated before that, you become very dependent on that and it kind of feeds it, doesn't it? And your identity becomes more and more of that and it can be really hard to step away from. And I know she's really helpfully talked about, she's struggling a bit now, as she's just a little bit older, you know, she's not as kind of young and flexible and able to do some of the things that she used to do, doesn't look quite like she did before. And that's a real kind of grief as well. And has been really just challenging to navigate kind of moving from that kind of place to where she is now.
Yeah. And that is something that I feel I can somewhat relate to. You talked about grief and my body's changed as I've stepped away from elite sport and naturally exercised less. And I've eaten, you know, starting to eat in line with my hunger and fullness, and I've gained body fat, and I don't know how much I've gained, and I don't care how much I've gained, and I don't weigh myself, so I don't know how much weight I've gained or anything like this. You do grieve the body that you once had, and I think that to some extent is a really normal process, considering, and I think allow ourselves permission to experience that, because we live in a society that very much values appearance. We were part of a group whereby there was a part of a culture even whereby there was a pressure to appear a certain way, and we were respected for appearing a certain way. So it can almost feel threatening now that we don't appear a certain way, which is where I think a lot of self-compassion work comes in, and trying to treat ourselves with a slightly different attitude and cultivate a sense of understanding. And then also sticking to behaving in ways that are still helpful for us. And obviously we need to have the wisdom to know what is helpful for us. But that, I think, being and developing a sense of self-compassion is really important as we change, because it can be a really challenging thing.
So can you say a bit more about self-compassion? Because I think it's something that thankfully has been talked about a lot more, isn't it? But I think some people, and I'm imagining perhaps people as well who have been high performance athletes, fitness enthusiasts, when they think about being self-compassionate, they may be thinking, oh, well, that means I'm just going to kind of give up on my goals and let myself go. And, you know what I mean? Sit on the sofa and eat donuts all day or something. You know, I think as a society, we're not very good, are we, at kind of understanding what we really mean by self-compassion and really sort of embodying that?
No, absolutely. And I think it's probably made tougher by conflicting messages being shown, in particular on the online space. I'm thinking about Instagram, which is the social media platform I spend most time on. I know that there's a model by Christine Neff who talks more about kindness is a key part to self-compassion for her model. I personally prefer Paul Gilbert's model, and I've toyed, and I'll go into what that model talks about and promotes in a second, but I've toyed with the word self-compassion, because really, I think, went on George Mycock's podcast as well, we spoke about this, about wording and whether or not it puts particularly athletes or fitness enthusiasts or people who have a high drive for muscularity or any of this stuff, whether it puts them off, because as you just said, it sounds like you're going to let yourself go. And that's because people have spent so long motivating themselves by the threat system. Mm. And we see this with perfectionists. Sure, I could motivate myself to go to the gym 3 times a day at times when I had a high drive for leanness. I was in the running to trying to become as fit as possible. And I felt that was a helpful thing to do. But really, that drive to do that came from a fear of me not doing it, me not being good enough if I don't push myself to the absolute max, me not gaining the social status that I so desperately needed from being lean and from receiving compliments or praise from other people. And there's other motivational systems that we can drive from. And to engage in those other more helpful and more sustainable, and when I say helpful, I mean healthy. They're more healthy motivation systems for the long run because they don't damage our psychological well-being. They're more sustainable. They result in an ability to engage within the behavior without negative psychological outcomes. What we need to do is develop a level of self-acceptance in order to develop these other motivational systems. So athletes think they'll let themselves go if they don't criticize themselves into action or whip themselves up into shape or engage in this, you've got to give everything up in order to be the best sort of mentality. And really, that's not true, because when we build a solid level of self-acceptance, which we can do through self-compassionate exercises, we are giving ourselves a far more stable base to fail from, to take risks from, to push ourselves from. Because we know that if we don't end up succeeding, our whole sense of self isn't on the line. We're not about to condemn ourselves. We're not about to feel awful. We're not as fragile because we have this solid sense of self to fall back on, rather than this really fragile sense of self to fall back on. It's something that I still have to work on a lot. We see it a lot in perfectionists, and we see a lot of perfectionistic traits within athletes as well. So this is a really, really important topic for athletes. But self-compassion is not about just being kind. Self-compassion is about accepting ourselves. It's also about doing what is most helpful for ourselves. And sometimes that means doing things that are hard. And it doesn't mean just sitting back and doing the kindest thing for ourselves, which might be avoiding any situation that feels dangerous or risky. Instead, it means putting ourselves out there and moving towards our goals, provided that our goals are based or sort of come from a healthy place of self-acceptance rather than fear. It means that we can take risks knowing that we are not going to be overly self-critical to ourselves, and we're going to treat ourselves with an attitude of kindness, respect, love, and warmth. But also, we're going to become more resilient to that failure and to the emotional turmoil that can often come with pursuing our goals and driving for excellence. I often think the difference between an unhealthy pursuit for athletic prowess and sort of a healthy drive for athletic excellence is a strong base of self-compassion and self-acceptance. And if we have those things, we also know that dieting ends up becoming less of a risk factor for disordered eating and eating disorders. And I think that's one thing that, just really quickly, I know I've talked for a while there and rambled on, I haven't really got to the point very quickly, but one thing that I think is important to say is that I am not completely anti-diet. I am pro people establishing a relationship with food that does not depend on external measures. I am pro people being able to get to a place where they can eat intuitively. But then if someone does compete in a weight class sport and they've got high levels of self-compassion, they've got a healthy relationship with food pre-diet, and they've got a high levels of positive body image, a short period of intentional weight loss to pursue a meaningful goal whilst under the guidance of an appropriately trained coach or dietitian or nutritionist, and whilst being monitored, is as safe a diet as you can do. So I do incorporate quote unquote safe dieting within the flourishing athlete model, because I think it might be unavoidable for certain sports, and I don't want to exclude, I don't want people to feel it excluded because they're in a weight class sport or they're in a sport that does require short periods of weight loss in order to compete within their sport. But self-compassion and self-acceptance and a positive body image and all these things sort of go hand in hand, and a sort of a baseline positive relationship with food is highly protective if someone was to go into a dieting phase. And I will also say that I don't recommend that everyone just jumps in to that. I think that's something that should be really discussed if you've got any history of disordered eating. And if you have a history of an eating disorder, it's highly, highly, highly unlikely that I would ever recommend intentional weight loss as a means to pursue athletic excellence.
Yeah, and I think everything you're just sort of saying there as well, like, I guess it's just really drumming the message home, isn't it? For athletes and fitness professionals and just for society in general, really, if we can really embed this sort of self-compassion and people can learn from a younger age, this sort of self-compassion, self-acceptance, we've just got such a stronger base for our mental well-being, haven't we, to just be able to kind of navigate all kinds of challenges. And so interesting what you're saying about the dieting. Like, I kind of hear what you're sort of saying there, actually, like if someone's kind of doing it with the support, et cetera. I mean, it's so interesting because I know myself. I mean, I've recovered from bulimia now for, gosh, 20 plus years. I know for myself, if I went on a extreme diet, I could be vulnerable, I think, to slipping back just through that alone. And I haven't sort of binged and purged for like donkey's years. You know what I mean? So it's an interesting one, isn't it? And I don't know if that's absolutely true or not, but I'm not going to go and test it out, to be honest with you. But interesting, isn't it? I think just knowing one's own vulnerabilities, and I guess every individual is slightly different. But I think I know for me, just even any form of restriction, even after all the years of work I've done on myself and the self-compassion, that physiological restriction would have quite a powerful impact, I think, for me. But, you know, I haven't tested it out, but that's my gut feeling.
I think the same for me. It's not something I would do for myself, knowing what my relationship with food has been and the effect that physiological, as you said, sort of physiological restriction or has had on me. It's not something that I'm willing to risk, because, you know, that's a key part. You've got to understand that is a risk. Going and doing a dieting is an absolute risk. There's a number of different factors that need to be taken into account before someone even considers that. And it is the absolute last thing that I would ever cover. I am sort of 95% anti-diet. I don't think that dieting exists or is needed for many athletes at all. I don't think that tracking your macros and external food plans and the sort of obsession that that can bring and the food preoccupation and the body monitoring that is required to go alongside it, I don't think any of that's needed for a lot of athletes. For certain athletes, if you are a boxer and there is a requirement for you to drop some weight, we would look at your motivations to drop weight, your previous dieting behaviors, your attitudes towards food, your attitudes towards your body and yourself, why it is you want to do it, how we're going to monitor day on day or week on week the effects it's having, what's the strategy if we do feel like it's having a negative effect. And again, as I said, if there's ever been a recognized eating disorder previously, I don't think it's ever something that I could ever recommend. So it's a really careful one to navigate. And it's one that I've toyed with a long time to whether or not to include it in the model, because my values sort of say it's not needed. But then for certain sports, perhaps it is. And perhaps it could be done safely with appropriate support if you have your hand held and if you have had a lot of screening done prior to the intentional weight loss. But yeah, I'm not a pro diet professional. That's not what I recommend. And it's the absolute last part of the model for the sort of 1% of athletes that might ever need to do it out there.
I think it really helps to talk about, isn't it? Because I think with everything in life, I think there's always nuance. It's not helpful to be completely black and white, is it? I think that there is always nuance. And I think you've just explained it all really well there. Actually, it would be done with a lot of thought and consideration. So Matt, can I just ask you another question as well that's just interested, like the perfectionism and your perfectionism in sport and all the rest of it. And I'm guessing other areas of life as well. And this could be a massive question, so don't feel like you need to answer it in huge depth, because I know we're probably coming to the end of the podcast quite soon. Do you feel with your perfectionism, is it more a nature or a nurture thing? Or do you think it's quite a combination of the two?
I absolutely think it's a combination of the two. I absolutely do. I think that there's a lot of importance on looking at the nurture, because you can't change the nature And there's a lot of what we can't change, we have to accept. And it definitely has to have some level of nurture, because I know lots of accounts of people who have worked on their perfectionism and who have come out the other side and feel like they don't feel as controlled by their perfectionism. It's something that I've struggled with a lot. And if I go back to sort of my school days, I'd find it really hard to deal with a grade that wasn't the best. I remember sort of in my GCSEs, I ended up doing quite well, and I sort of, it actually started going downhill after GCSEs, if I'm being honest. I got 6 A stars and 4 A's and a B, but that B was the bit that really brought me down, and it wasn't able to really celebrate the 6 A stars for a while, which obviously was a lot of hard work went into that. I don't think I'm particularly academically gifted. I worked incredibly hard. I was up at 5 o'clock in the morning working, and worked after school as well. And I worked every lunchtime, and I was really driven, and I felt like I really had to succeed in order to be worthy and to be valued. And I think that perfectionism, I often think, is actually quite an unhealthy term, because what people think it is a need to be perfect. But really, I think it's more to do with a high standard that we set ourselves, or that we feel has been set upon us, that is almost impossible to attain. And that if we do attain, gives us fleeting feelings of self-worth and of, I guess, positive emotion, but unfortunately perpetuates the cycle of perfectionism, because it then becomes this addictive chase to feel any level of self-worth again. I guess the opposite of perfectionism is self-acceptance and self-compassion. And for me, that's the best work you can do on perfectionism, is based on those, because I think that's at the root of it. I think you can do lots of CBT based interventions on challenging thought patterns and thinking habits and all of this stuff that might crop up and manifest. But what underlies perfectionism is a really fragile sense of self, one whereby if we do not achieve, we don't feel as though we have performed, and we don't feel like we are worthwhile. We are lovable. Well, there might be different beliefs underlying it. But for me, a lot of my perfectionism also results in procrastination or avoidance, because I don't want to take on tasks that could result in that. The anticipation of feeling worthless and of feeling vulnerable, you know, that others won't see me as worthy and won't think fondly of me, is, or has been in the past, crippling. So it's really meant that I've avoided a lot of things as well as worked hard. So it's manifested in different areas of my life. For sports and exercise, it's manifested in me being able to work extremely hard in the gym, because I know that if I do, I have a certainty of an outcome that I can improve myself towards where I need to get to. For other areas where I've been less sure whether the work will lead towards that outcome, it causes high levels of procrastination and putting behaviors off and avoiding behaviors. But I've worked a lot on it. It's something I've worked a lot on, and I think I have made a lot of progress on. And one thing that I certainly think is important to recognize, and that the Flourishing Athlete certainly promotes, is that we're all work in progress. We always have things to try and improve on, and we have to have the wisdom to know what those things are. And then we've got to have the compassion to be able to take action on trying to improve those aspects of us, so that we can live a flourishing life, a worthwhile life. Because we only get, well, in my belief, we only get one shot at it. And it's important to do what we can to flourish within that life and to get the most out of it. So I haven't really answered your question there, have I?
I think it's really, really interesting. I mean, to be honest with you, I could talk to you about that for ages, actually. And like, you know, I think there's so many layers to it. But no, I think it's so helpful, though, because I think so many people listening really do struggle a lot with perfectionism. I mean, it's so interesting because I have struggled with many different things in my life, but one of them is not perfectionism. I really am just a bit more kind of, really, I'm perhaps a bit too much the other way. You know, I'm good enough. That's probably why my podcast is still going. You know what I mean? Because I do look sideways at people sometimes and just think, goodness, there's so many talented people out there, but people don't put themselves forward often, do they? Because of that perfectionism. Whereas I can see sometimes, actually, because in that area, I mean, I definitely struggle in other areas. I'm not saying that I'm sorted 100%, but I can really recognize the freedom to be able to just have a go at things, or, you know, just pursue things sometimes without that fear in the same way. Whereas Yeah, when you're a perfectionist, it can be crippling, can't it? But again, like you're sort of saying, in a way, you've done a lot of work on it as well, and part of the flourishing athlete as well. And again, it really comes back to that compassion and acceptance, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a fantastic strength to have and to recognise that you have, and something that you can capitalise on, that strength. And that's a really positive thing to recognise and a positive trait to capitalise on, because, yeah, you're right. There are so many talented and passionate people out there who never put themselves out there or live a life in accordance with their values or their true passions or their true calling, if you want to call it that, because of crippling perfectionism and anxiety as to if it fails. Yeah, it's a really interesting topic, and everyone's on a spectrum with it somewhere. So even if you don't resonate with being really high on the spectrum, it might be worthwhile just thinking where you fall on that spectrum. What does stop you going forth with behaviours that you know are helpful, or that you think would make your life better? Because it might be other things, of course. I'm not saying that perfectionism is the only thing that can, maladaptive perfectionism, should I say, is the only thing that can prevent progress, but it certainly can be one that can put the brakes on pretty quickly.
So Matt, where can people find you if they want to get in touch, find out more about the Flourishing Athlete, etc.?
Yeah, sure. So Instagram's the best place, just the Flourishing Athlete. Yeah, give me a follow, but also give me a message. I quite like it when people sort of give me a follow and then reach out and say, hey, this is my story and this is what I do. I quite like interacting with people. So Instagram's the best place. And yeah, feel free to say, hey.
Okay, lovely. Well, I shall make sure that is in the show notes. Thank you so much, Matt, for coming on today. Just really appreciate you sharing all your wisdom, your story. And I know it's going to inspire and help so many people. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Harriet. I appreciate you inviting me on.
So I hope you enjoyed this conversation just as much as I did. Do go and check out Matt's details, The Flourishing Athlete, in the show notes. If you're not following me already on Instagram, do seek me out, The Eating Disorder Therapist _. And for further support with your relationship with food, do go to theeatingdisordertherapist.co.uk. If you enjoy this podcast, I would be so grateful if you'd follow, rate and review, as it helps it reach so many more listeners. And if you're professional listening and you want to up your skills in body image and eating disorders, you might be interested in my online courses. Links are in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening today, and I look forward to sharing another podcast episode with you very soon.